I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In an area on the east side of Troost, known as Wendell Phillips, a stretch of vacant buildings and empty lots stand in dire need of attention. Today, we sit down with a Kansas City couple determined to revitalize the overlooked neighborhood and avoid gentrifying it at the same time. Their business, Movement KC, is gaining notice for its approach, and we'll learn how their model seeks to rebuild communities. After that, the role of immigration in an earlier century of American history. We'll look at who came here starting in 1820 and the reception they received and compare their experience to that of immigrants today. All that and the weekend to-do list will get you up to date after this hour's news. Building a house is a lot of work. Developing a whole block of houses requires an enormous investment of time and money. And re-envisioning and creating an entire neighborhood, especially in a place with a history of economic hardship, perhaps aggravated by racism at one time systematically enforced, well, you might think that's just about impossible. But one Kansas City couple is working to defy the odds in an East Side neighborhood. Their company, Movement KC, is attracting attention and some investment for its effort to redevelop a community in a way that builds community. Daniel and Ebony Edwards, business partners and also husband and wife, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
Glad you guys are here. So, Dan, how do you describe this to people? What is Movement KC?
Movement KC is really a campaign to take to do whatever it takes in order to rebuild the Wendell Phillips into a global neighborhood.
Is it a business?
It is a business, but for us, it's been more of a movement. A lot of people have talked to us and said, why have you started this and why did you call it that? And there is a friend of ours that says somebody just needs to start a movement to rebuild. And I was like, well, that's what we'll do. And we'll just call it Movement KC. And so it's more of a long-term initiative to see a neighborhood rebuilt.
How's it different than your standard sort of real estate development company?
Standard real estate development company looks at a plot of land. They see highest and best use. They run the numbers, see how much they can cash flow the deal for. If the numbers don't work, they don't do the deal. If the numbers don't work, unless they use affordable tax credits or low-income housing tax credits, primarily in the hood or on the east side, they don't do the deal. If they can make the numbers work and it displaces people in the process, but they could still make the deal cash flow, they will do the deal and they won't worry about the impact of that. So the way that we've done it is we've actually we're from the neighborhood. We're from the community. We focused on the hearts of the people, and then we make the numbers work to fit the needs of the community.
So you don't intend to lose money. This isn't a charity.
No, this is not a charitable contribution project. It is a mission-driven initiative, but no, it's not. It's a for-profit entity.
Ebony Edwards, I know you have a PhD in community psychology. For both of you, your goals for this work go beyond the financial implications. What, in your view, goes into making a real community? What is it you're after?
Well, we're really looking for programming that can make the community thrive, everyone in the community. We're looking for programming that can really touch a person regardless of kind of what status they have, any characteristics that they have. One of the things that we do before we actually do any work is we take a holistic perspective to what has happened from a development perspective and from a community perspective in the past, and really pay particular attention to what assets are in the community that we can build on, that people connect with, that we feel like can help bring the community together and also propel different aspects forward.
So it sounds like you're talking about more than fixing up houses in a given block.
Absolutely. We are very interested and invested in social outcomes, anything that can touch the economy, but also education, health is very important. The health department here has done some important studies on looking at discrepancy in life expectancies, depending on, frankly, if you're in neighborhoods east of Troost versus west of Troost.
Those are pretty startling numbers.
Absolutely. Different. Absolutely. Yeah. More than 10 years is what they found. And so we know that housing is an important ingredient to that kind of an impact. But in addition to that, how can we make sure that if we are redeveloping housing, that we're doing so in a way that's sensitive to everyone that's involved in that process?
Well, let's talk about the neighborhood. You mentioned Wendell Phillips. For those who don't know, that's from the Paseo to Prospect, from 18th Street in the north to 27th Street in the south, give or take. What's happening in that neighborhood now? Describe Wendell Phillips for those who aren't familiar with the neighborhood.
Well, so what everybody knows about Wendell Phillips, but they don't know it's Wendell Phillips, is 18th and Vine.
Right.
So
the 18th, that's the northern edge of the
That's the northern edge of the neighborhood. A lot of the attention has been attracted towards the 18th and Vine, obviously, the 18th Street connector. And that's been really decades of just talk about the strip. Very few people have actually started to explore south of the strip. There are some recent developments that have been happening in Monarch Manor, and some other developments around 22nd and Olive. But it really has been commercial focused and not really neighborhood and resident focused. So residents, neighbors, communities have all took the back seat to watching all the attention at 18th and Vine.
When we think of the money the city has poured in, it's all been to that, to the business district
there. It's all been a commercial, which is somewhat backwards compared to how most developments take place. Most of the time there in any stabilized neighborhood, you have homeowners who stabilize that community, and then commercial amenities come after it. This was done the exact opposite way, which I think is a big reason why I struggled to really see where it can be at.
Well, paint the picture then of the residential part of this neighborhood. There are homes there.
Yeah, there's homes there. There used to be 41,547 people in this neighborhood by 1948. There were over 15,000 homes that were in this neighborhood. Today, there are less than 3,000 people that still live in the neighborhood.
Wow, from 41,000 to 3,000.
To 3,000. From 15,000 homes to less than 2,000 that are actually habitable. We technically have more vacant land in our neighborhood than we do homeowners.
And when you drive through, you see that. It's lot. There's a house, then yep. lot. How did that happen?
They call it density. So if you go to like South Hyde Park, which is a popular neighborhood, they're doing about 10 homes per acre. So if you go down the block, you see homes on both sides of the street all the way down. In our neighborhood, we're at about 2.9, to be more technical, but we're about 3 homes per acre. So you literally are just seeing vacancy everywhere. Urban renewal, I would say once black people could move outside of their boundaries, and we did, we left the neighborhood, we left the community, people took their resources with them, city came back in and demolished everything, buried it all underground, which is why it's taken us so long to get off the ground. And then people just left the community. So there's a remnant of people who still remained, and we want to bless them, I guess, with protecting them as we rebuild.
Protecting them, meaning you don't want what comes in to force them to leave.
Right. So most developers, the social ramifications of development is too much to worry about. For us, it's everything that drives us. So I'm actually a commissioner on the Land Clearance for Redevelopment Authority through the EDC, Enhanced Enterprise Zone. I've been a commissioner for 7 years. There are tools that we have today that we could put in place in order to protect existing residents long term. So if you've lived in this neighborhood all your life, you should never have to worry about your property taxes going up, which is where it comes from. You have a couple million dollars come into a neighborhood, people's property taxes skyrocket that can't afford that. We have tools in place today that we can implement that the city has been very slow to implement, but we can do that.
So what you're talking about is sometimes called gentrification.
Yes.
When property values start to go up in a neighborhood such that those who lived in the neighborhood no longer can or perhaps want to,
right.
to live there. Ebony, what is so bad about gentrification? I mean, on a superficial level, adding amenities to the neighborhood, increasing property values, making things nicer seems like a good thing.
Yeah, it's something we talk about a lot, which is, you know, what we actually don't use the term gentrification because it includes all of those things. And so what we're really trying to do is advocate for those more positive things that you talked about. But again, really just wanting to do it in a just way. Which is making sure that everything that we add to a neighborhood that positively impacts a neighborhood can be experienced by people who currently live there and who have histories and legacies in this neighborhood. For us, it's really about protecting that legacy.
Yeah, and I think that there's the gentrification, we use that term as a catch-all. And what we're really talking about that we've kind of broken it down to is financial displacement and cultural displacement. So yes, you can displace people financially through property taxes, but what often happens is that culturally, you have a new group of people who come into a neighborhood. They may be in the same economic range, but they don't adapt to the existing environment or the existing community, and they put their own institutions on the people that are there.
So I want to ask this question sort of gently, but are there people you don't want to move into the neighborhood in this development you're doing?
Absolutely.
Say more. Who should not come to this neighborhood?
I call them buttholes.
Well, all right. We can air that.
I'll say it that way. But no, I think when people asked us about what is our perspective on gentrification, I was taken to a Bible verse, and it said that people with glee and malice in their hearts come in to destroy the neighborhood. Or it was the children of Israel at that point in time. But I think it's people who have motives that are selfish, and they are geared towards what can I get out of this situation that's going to best benefit us. It comes out in various ways, but I think those types are people that we want to try to keep away. If you come to us and say, hey, we really want to be a part of this, we don't want to displace people, I prefer that over you coming to me and saying, well, how much does a home cost? Because then you have no care and concern about the social dynamics of what you're doing.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. If you have questions about Movement KC, about efforts to rebuild the Wendell Phillips neighborhood, maybe other parts of the East Side, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also post on Twitter. We'll take a look at that, at KCUR Up to Date. Go ahead and play amateur community developer. What do you think needs to go into rebuilding neighborhoods like Wendell Phillips? Let me ask you both, sort of getting down to the nitty-gritty here, and not sort of this general idea that we want it to be a better neighborhood, but specifically, what are you doing right now? I know you mentioned to me that you're kind of at phase 2.0 of this project. What has already happened and what is yet to happen, Ebony?
Well, we've done a lot of, people have heard of our feast, which is essentially where we invite people in this. So far, we've invited people into our homes to develop relationships over a dinner table, where we invite chefs in as well who actually cook in our home. And so we develop relationships. And that's really about breaking down what we found to be social barriers, where people have told us that they don't necessarily feel invited into this neighborhood. And so we're looking for ways to expand that initiative and addressing specifically the work that we're doing in the neighborhood. We've also done things like invite families to the park in the neighborhood itself, where we actually build relationships with those who are living there and kind of just talk about what it is that we're doing. And we have a really big component around jazz, where we're expanding as well into to be more about other art forms of music and creativity. But with jazz, really just
as a messenger.
Yeah, as a messenger. I was going to say recruiting artists into what we're doing as well. Yeah.
That's some of the programming, some of the things that are designed to sort of capture people's minds and hearts around this. Mm-hmm. How about the money? I mean, financially, What's happening in terms of property and houses?
Yeah, so we took a big step and we acquired about 40 lots over in the neighborhood some time ago.
These are vacant lots?
Vacant lots.
Okay.
But once we started to break ground, or once we started to get to that point of breaking ground, we recruited neighbors. So we had neighbors lined up and ready to go for the deal. That was kind of the easier part. But then once you go out and do soil surveys, you find that there are old buried homes and apartment buildings buried underground from the urban renewal days in the 60s. They would just come in and demolish everything. So our budgets have skyrocketed for our buyers, and that's why we've been really pushing the city to say, hey, city, you guys demoed this a long time ago, and new buyers are having to pay for that. And I think that's where the more nitty-gritty technical side, you have developments like Beacon Hill. They're putting homes on the market for $300 and $400, up to $800 now, which is the next neighborhood over. But somebody has to pay to clear all that crap out the ground. And if you stick that on the buyers, you then take the homes away from being affordable or attainable. So you could have a buyer who can afford a house of $150,000, and then you have to pay for streets, infrastructure, digging out a home. You add $70,000 to $80,000 on top of that. It's out of their price range. The bank is not going to do that for them. So I think that's why we've been finding that there's been a lot of higher-end luxury homes and luxury housing going in Kansas City because...
Including in Beacon Hill, right across the street from this.
Definitely in Beacon Hill.
Yeah.
So,
do you feel like banks are responding positively to you? Are you finding financing for this project?
It was a rough journey for the first... until last month.
Okay. What happened last month?
Up until last month, banks have still been redlining. They don't say it that way.
Redlining, sort of the practice of half a century ago of saying these parts of the city are not places where we will support development, especially for African-American communities.
Yep, and they say, oh, well, we don't know the neighborhood, and oh, well, there's no developments east of Troost or east of 71 Highway, and oh, you're never going to find buyers for it. And so we've had to overcome those hurdles. Fortunately, Kansas City is a relationship-based town. We've been blessed to have some fairy godmothers and fairy godfathers who have introduced us to some institutions around here. And we're excited. We just received a commitment from a bank to do site development for an entire block of 25th in Michigan and then build 50 homes on that single block. So now we need the city to come on board and invest to help us clear all this out. And we can start to rebuild this neighborhood.
When do you want to see the first new neighbors moving into this neighborhood as a result of your work?
Well, so we are one household of the first new neighbors. So immediately, in an ideal scenario, we're breaking ground within the next 30 to 45 days. We're getting the site cleared out, and then
on the land that you two will live in.
On the land that we're living in, our first 10 buyers. So we have our first 10 buyers that are ready to go. We have been courting them and building relationships. We've raised our families together now at this point in time. We have drinks. We eat together. We do all that stuff together.
And you're doing this sort of I don't want to say in exile, but you're living in Mannheim Park right now, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. A couple neighborhoods away. But you hope this changes within a month or two.
Yes, that would be great.
Ebony, I know this is not merely an academic exercise for the two of you. It's also personal. You're from here, and you're raising a family. What impact does that have on your desire to do this and how you're going about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's been really special is the ability to develop neighbors and relationships prior to making the move. And so really getting to know, as Daniel said, our neighbors, but also their children, allowing our children to play together, talking about, Daniel likes to talk about the desires in our hearts together, really getting to develop those kind of relationships. And then also, my background is such that I care about any community. It doesn't really matter where I'm living. Communities that are under-resourced or that have been disenfranchised for whatever reason for years. But the fact that we are moving to this neighborhood is really an opportunity for me to be present in any work that I'm doing, to build sustaining relationships as well, and get to experience my work, which I don't always get to do.
You know, I have to think that you study this field, you are very deeply invested in the transformation, but you also are a mom with two kids, and you picking up and moving into a neighborhood that hasn't gotten there yet, that doesn't have all those amenities, that has a lower economic standard right at this moment. Does it feel a little bit risky? Is that hard to do?
There's some history there in our relationship. Actually, I went away for college and grad school, and when I came back, I actually wanted to. If the day I moved back, I would not be moving to this block. Definitely would say that. And we looked at some homes in the area, but as you said, it's vacant lot home, vacant lot, vacant lot home. So in the beginning, it was, yeah, this is a great area, but I will have no neighbors. I don't want to move into this neighborhood, and it's just, us alone on a block, right?
Yeah, that's literally how we became developers, is because I had to go find her neighbor so she wouldn't be by herself on a block. And that just spiraled.
So Dan won you over.
Yeah, Dan won me over.
I had to.
He had to bring me here, to bring me back to Kansas City.
I had to sell her on the vision.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, like really the relationship building is really key to what we're doing. For us, definitely. And I think for the families involved, too.
So you hope to make the first groundbreaking and moves here 30 to 45 days. When will we see when will we be having you back in here to talk about the Wendell Phillips Neighborhood Association and all of the successes that that you've achieved with a whole group of neighbors?
Well, so I think February 1, we're relaunching. We're coming up with a campaign to actually start to engage the artists on a more serious level. We're working on a commercial property that will be all dedicated towards artists, which is across the street from our development. And I know the big thing that we want to accomplish, I know we talked a lot about the grassroots things, but the bigger vision of this is, as Crossroads is the visual arts neighborhood of Kansas City, Wendell Phillips, which is directly adjacent, should be the performing arts neighborhood of Kansas City. And we've done a horrible job with getting that reputation of where it should be at, and that's where we're trying to move it to.
That's Daniel Edwards and Ebony Edwards. They are business partners, husband and wife, and the leaders of Movement KC, which is trying to revitalize the Wendell Phillips neighborhood in a healthy community way. So thanks both of you for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Really glad you could be here. When we come back, more than 40 million immigrants arrived in this country over the course of a century that ended in 1924. We'll talk about the very different reception newcomers got in this country a century ago. Plus, Brian McTavish has our weekend to-do list. Stick around. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, how partisanship is changing Americans' understanding of public service. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Steve Kraske's back in the chair for an exit interview with former Senator Claire McCaskill. She may have left the Senate, but she is still passionate about the work of Congress and not afraid to tweet about it. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. Today, famine in Ireland, a gold rush in California, economic hardship, and persecution of Jews in Central and Eastern Europe. A lot of factors led a steady stream of immigrants to make their way to the United States from not long after its independence to the period just after World War I. Those newcomers, perhaps 40 million in all, faced a reception in some ways different than immigrants do today. And maybe in some ways not so different. One thing is for certain, the influx shaped the nation we have become. On this day, when the president is visiting the nation's southern border to campaign for funding for a physical barrier, we're talking about the so-called century of immigration from 1820 to 1924. And joining us to do that is Sandra Enriquez. She teaches history here at UMKC. Sandra, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's really nice to have you. And we should mention that Sandra will be leading a post-film discussion on Monday, January 14th, at the Kansas City Public Library on this subject. We'll say a little more about that in a moment. Sandra, let's talk about that so-called century of immigration. Who were the immigrants from 1820 to 1924?
So the immigrants that we are talking about in the center of immigration are mostly coming from Europe at the time. So you have two waves. The first part, beginning from like the 1820s until the dawn of the Civil War, are mostly coming from Northern Europe and Central Europe. So you have people coming from France, Ireland, especially following the potato famine before and prior to that, or before and after that, Germany, Scandinavia. And so that's the first wave of European immigrants. And then following that, beginning maybe like after the Civil War until the 1920s, you have a large number of Central Europeans and Eastern Europeans coming. So people from Italy, Poland, what became the Czech Republic, Greece, parts of the Ottoman Empire, they're all coming into the United States. And so those are the largest groups that came in.
Millions of people who are slowly but surely changing kind of the character, certainly the cultural character of the mm-hmm. United States at that time. How were they received initially by the Americans who were already here?
So sometimes it depends. Right. Not much has changed. So many. I will get into the good part first. Some Americans opening their arms to immigrants. You have the settlement house movement, where settlement houses were built in neighborhoods and ethnic neighborhoods across the country, where they allowed where women, for the most part, were able to help immigrant communities assimilate or acculturate to the United States. So they would learn English and give them skills that would help them succeed in life. But also we had a resurgence of nativism. So people that believe that immigrants were coming to the United States and taking their jobs, that they were not assimilating to American culture, that they were not learning English, that they just wanted to remain tied to their country of origin, that they were drunkards, or that their religion wasn't the right religion. So the same stereotypes that we see today and scapegoating that we see today was very prevalent as well at the turn of the century.
So you're talking now about the turn of the 20th century, 1900
yes.
era. And that's interesting to hear. These are groups that today, when we think about, let's say, Irish Americans or German Americans, we think of as culturally so intertwined with U.S. culture that it's hard to imagine people seeing that as so other.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see how our conceptions of immigration and the negatives that we see of immigration just find another group and how they transition. And we say that these earlier groups were able to attain whiteness, right? But as non-Western groups were coming into the United States throughout the 20th century, that changes the dynamics of immigration and how we perceive it today.
You know, a term that has been used in the past and basically is rejected these days is this term of melting pot, the idea that all of these cultures sort of get stirred up in a big stew and mixed together and lose their individual identity. Is there some sense in which that happened in these waves of immigration from Europe?
Yeah, and particularly in places like New York City became very cosmopolitan at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. And also, I think that we forget that Europe was very regional at this time. And so you have immigrants coming from southern Italy, from various regions that maybe were not necessarily speaking the same dialect, that melded together because they had the geographic country of origin as something in common. So that's very important. Like, not only were immigrants coming and becoming part of the city into a very multicultural and diverse city, but also they were finding bonds over religion, over their country of origin and cultural and their cultural backgrounds.
You know, we talk about Ellis Island. Of course, there was it's been celebrated in film and in documentaries as this nexus, this hub for new voices, new cultures, new people coming into the country. How many of these immigrants did in fact come through Ellis Island, or were there ports of entry all over?
So there were several, but Ellis Island saw the largest influx of immigrants at the time. It has been estimated that about 40 million people did come in through Ellis Island.
Wow.
I'm an immigrant myself. I grew up on the southern border, and El Paso, for example, El Paso, Texas, is deemed as the Ellis Island of the Southwest. Angel Island in California is deemed as another Ellis Island, right? So there were various ports of entry depending on where you were coming from, right? Oftentimes, Ellis Island takes kind of this notoriety because it's European immigrants coming in, whereas Asian immigrants were coming in through the Western coast as, you know, people from Mexico and Latin America were coming in from the South. So there's different narratives that our American history tends to overlook because they were not necessarily European immigrants.
Well, how strong is that comparison you just made? You said El Paso is in some ways the Ellis Island of today.
Of today, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Not, I mean, historically, at the same around the same time.
Oh, around the same time.
Yeah,
El Paso
yeah.
was a southern
yes,
port.
Well, a point of entry.
Well, let me turn the conversation to today then. There are border entries at the southern border, which are the scene of a lot of immigration today. How different is the experience of an immigrant arriving in the U.S. today from what the Irish potato famine transplant experienced at Ellis Island?
Oh, I think that our immigration process is so different. When we talk about the 1800s and early 1900s, there was not necessarily any immigration laws. They started to come in place until 1924, when we see the catalyst and the end of the century of immigration, as we establish the National Origins Act of 1924, which establishes a quota. So that changes the way that immigration is seen federally and statewide. And so that has an implication for today, because, you don't have, with the exception of what is happening right now with the migrant immigrant caravan who's coming to seek refuge in the United States and asylum, you really don't see the long lines of, boats dropping off immigrants into Ellis Island. There's processes. And so what we think of Ellis Island today, we can expand it to states that are receiving the largest influx of immigrants. So places like Texas, places like California, and even to, I think, New York State is third in immigrant population. So our conceptions of how we see Ellis Island has changed, right? And so these are the places that are receiving larger influx of immigrants.
I want to ask you about the event that's coming up Monday evening at the library. The film is called Becoming American, The Century of Immigration. It's the first in a six-week series of film screenings and discussions that the Kansas City Public Library is hosting at the Central Branch. You're going to lead a post-film discussion. What should people who come to that event expect?
Well, first, we will be spending the first hour of the event on Monday. We will be watching a documentary, so the first one will set the stage for the rest of the 6-week series. We'll learn about New York and New York and the role of the center of immigration. And then after the film screening, there will be a discussion. So what I think it's neat about this Becoming American program is that there, oftentimes we go to a lecture, we might be able to ask a question or two on the audience, and then we go home, but we really have no dialogue. And that is not what this program is about. This program is about the film screening and then utilizing the additional hour afterwards to have a community dialogue about not only the film screenings, but how the larger issues of immigration, both historic and contemporary, tie into the film itself. So we are hoping to create community dialogue and through that community dialogue to be able to understand the historic ramifications of immigration and understand immigration history altogether.
Sandra, I want to ask you, as an historian, as someone who has studied the history of immigration in this country, when you look at that history and you look at what's happening today, the level of conflict and dialogue, if you can call it that, about immigration, what do you think we today need to be paying attention to out of the past? What lessons are there to take to this current dialogue?
I think understanding that it's a very complex process and understanding why people want to be here in the first place, right? A lot of folks who are immigrating are fleeing political repression. They're fleeing socioeconomic hardships. And I think that's something that we could do as people is put ourselves in their shoes, right? Humanizing immigrants and seeing their experiences, right? I think that we let current social perceptions dictate what we think about immigration. And I think that learning from the past and making those connections to today is really important to understand the complexities and the difficulties that the immigrant population has been facing historically.
That's Sandra Enriquez. She teaches history here at UMKC, and she's leading a post-film discussion next Monday at 6:30 at the Central Library. You can get more information or RSVP at kclibrary.org. Speaking of the library, even with all the publicity around keeping immigrants out of the country, the reality is that thousands do become citizens every year through various government programs. The Kansas City Public Library has a program called Refugee and Immigration Services and Empowerment, or RISE, that helps potential future citizens navigate all of that. And Becca Rendell coordinates that program. Becca, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you here. So what kind of programs are part of the library's effort here?
Yeah, so the RISE division at the library really exists to do two different things: to bring refugees and immigrants into the library and help connect them with the quality lifelong learning opportunities that the Kansas City Public Library has to offer.
Same ones they'd have for everyone.
Yeah. but also to take the library out to this historically hard to reach population for libraries. And it's historically hard to reach largely because of language and cultural differences and things like if you're coming from a country that doesn't have a free public library. You can imagine you see this place, you don't know what it is, you don't know if it's safe. We want to make sure that the library is a safe place. In order to do that, we offer specific programming, both educational, like the Becoming American series, but we also offer programming for people with limited English proficiency, or as you stated before, people looking to become U.S. citizens.
So what kind of programs? You mm-hmm. teach them English?
So yes, we do classroom and one-to-one English language learning opportunities. So that's really for anyone who wants to access those programs. We pair up people with community volunteers who really are there to help build the confidence of people to learn English and create a safe place to do so, but also to build relationships. We really are working towards a vision of people seeing refugees and immigrants as neighbors here in Kansas City. But then we also do have the citizenship program. So we have an English for Citizenship program. The naturalization interview, with few exceptions, must be done in English, and it's a whole oral interview. So a lot of people really need to learn that specific English necessary to pass that. And the last thing we ever want is for someone to have to apply twice or three times for citizenship. It's expensive. It costs $725 just to apply.
Wow.
We don't want anyone to have to go through that more than one time. And then we also do a citizenship interview practice, where it think a mock job interview, but for the citizenship interview. So that really helps build your confidence in being able to walk into the USCIS office and do the interview and know the answers and know that you are ready.
Wow. How many people does the library serve with these programs each year?
That's a great question. So we've actually expanded a lot of our programs in the last year. So the citizenship interview and the English in Action, which is our one-to-one English mentorship, just started in 2018. On average, every month we have around 40 folks who access our programs. So that could be any of the ones that I talked about. Mm-hmm. Certain months are bigger than others. So you can imagine December was down because of holidays.
I noticed on the website that you're actually asking for volunteers to work mm-hmm. with the library on this. What would volunteers do?
Yeah, so all of our programs are really volunteer fueled. So last year we had 60 unique individuals volunteer with our program, and we're very proud of that. They act as tutors. They act as citizenship interview practice givers. They really act as the USCIS officer in that. And then we're also very fortunate to host naturalization ceremonies, usually about two a year at the Central Library, and very grateful to the Friends of the Library and to other community members who volunteer to help people navigate the library on that day when they're becoming U.S. citizens.
You know, I'm thinking about how emotionally fraught this issue is, how conflicted the issue of immigration is in our current political moment. Do you get pushback for offering these programs? Have you had negative response in the community?
By and large, the answer is no. What we found in Kansas City is that people really want to welcome others. And so we're really taking that kind of Midwestern hospitality and making Kansas City a place where refugees and immigrants can be seen as neighbors, can be seen as friends. And that's really a lot of why our program exists, because a lot of people come to this country, they tell us it's really hard to make friends here, especially if you don't speak English, especially if you're in certain places. And to be able to put people in contact, we have been really grateful for that.
If people want more information, whether as refugees or possible immigrants or to volunteer, how should they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so our website is kclibrary.org/rise. There's a comment form on there. That's where you can sign up for all of our programs if you would like to be a volunteer or if you would like to be a participant. Or you can always shoot us an email at rise@kclibrary.org.
That's Becca Rendell. She's program coordinator for the RISE program at KC Public Library. We also have been speaking with Sandra Enriquez, history professor at UMKC, who's doing a post-film discussion about Becoming American, the Century of Immigration. That's next Monday at 6:30. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up next, Brian McTavish with our weekend to-do list.
Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe, if you don't know by now. Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe,
doesn't matter anyhow. When the rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. And you're the reason that I'm traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right.
And the reason it's all right is that KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here, who follows and writes about pop culture and joins us in the studio each week with ideas for your weekend. Hello, Brian.
Let me let that sink in.
Don't think twice.
Don't think twice.
It's all right.
See, I was guilty of thinking twice. And
we were just told not to think twice.
Okay. I'll do my best. Anyway, that is the ever-chipper, mandolin-plucking singer-songwriter Chris Thiele.
And radio host. Let's not forget the most important qualification
a person
can have.
Well, that's right. Today especially.
Yes.
Right. He will host the live broadcast of the folksy radio variety show formerly known as a Prairie Home Companion. Mm-hmm. It's now called, I love this title, Live from Here with Chris Thiele. 4:45 Saturday afternoon, you get yourself to Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. I guess the show comes on live at 5.
Yes.
And unless I'm sadly mistaken, this is still broadcast on our fine station,
It is. It is still broadcast at 5 o'clock on Saturdays.
I love it. And so you can listen to it, we encourage that. But you can also, even better, go to the Kauffman Center, be part of Live from Here with Chris Thiele.
Have you ever seen live radio, Brian?
Other than this, right now,
of course.
Yes, I'm experiencing it now. Yes, I made it out to Starlight once or twice with the former host of A Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor.
It's a lot of fun to go to those shows.
Well, it absolutely is. Now, I should mention, there'll be music, there'll be comedy, but I should mention that not showing up, although he was scheduled to appear, was special guest virtuoso roots guitarist Ry Cooder.
Oh, but not coming now.
No, he blew out a tendon in his right bicep. Ugh. Gosh, that hurts. And he can't play for a few weeks, but there will be plenty of Americana-friendly live entertainers performing live for the radio listening audience. Have a good time this weekend at this event.
That's coming up 4:45 p.m. on Saturday at the Kauffman Center.
Right.
They call him
Did you get into my playlist again, Brian?
Yep. I have to sample your faves. Doesn't that sound a little bit like an anime cousin of Speed Racer, the monster truck?
Right, kind of a darker version. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's a lot heavier for sure. It's Monster Jam. Monster trucks go nuts. What else could they do for family audiences? And that's what's interesting. Apparently, kids and families go for the monster truck thing. I might posit a guess as to why before we leave the air today.
I'm curious.
Okay. They're airborne. They're literally flipping 360 degrees in the air, these enormous tired vehicles. The question really isn't, if you're a monster truck fan, do I go? The question is, do I go to the 7 o'clock show Friday and the 1 in 7 show Saturday and the 1 o'clock show Sunday at Sprint Center? I think some people go to each and every one. Now, as
gets to be expensive.
Right. So, yeah. Well, come on,
yeah,
you know.
It's worth it.
Well, I mean, these the drivers of the Gravedigger and Zombie and El Toro Loco and others, they need their money. But why is this so popular? May I just share this with you?
Please tell me, Brian.
Other than being ridiculously awesome, I think it's very old school American, Brian. It's big and it's loud.
Mm-hmm.
And the gas-powered internal combustion engine, you know, we love it in America, even though we're going to go to electric cars and that's the right thing to do. But
right.
It's so in your face. I mean, when electric cars take over, who would really want to go see silently running electric monster trucks?
Right. I just don't see it happening.
I say no vroom, no thanks. So go
Is
check
that what
it
you
out.
Say?
That's what I just said. And you can say it too to people you meet randomly on the street today. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monster Jam Heaven at the Sprint Center.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 must-do things to do in Kansas City this weekend. That's at kcur.org.
Uh, Okay.
Brian, what are we listening to?
I'm going to tell you that is kid-building music. Can you see it now?
I'm sensing a theme in our musical selections today.
I'm doing my best. Okay, it's the engineering extravaganza in which kids will indeed build so cool, very cool stuff with the help of grown-up technical mentors. It's an all-day thing. It's 10 to 4 on Saturday. 10 to 4 on Saturday. Kids will love it at Pearson Auditorium at the UMKC Student Success Center. Lots of play-oriented engineering challenges, including designing and building hand-sized motorized robots and much, much more Saturday with Kids and Machines.
I look forward to it.
I do too.
Another noted kids song, Enya. No,
is
it's
it?
Not. I'm sorry,
is it?
We broke the theme there.
Well, it's for the child in your heart that still lives and enjoys me every time you're here with me. Okay.
I do.
So it's the Kansas City Bort and Boat.
Bort.
Bort.
Right.
It's the Kansas City Boat and Sports Show in which you can float your boat at this annual downtown attraction, even, Brian, if you're not shopping for a boat. It's today, it's Friday, it's Saturday, it's Sunday. Where else but Bartle Hall? Now, if you don't have the cash, you might, but I don't. But if you don't have the cash to sink into a new recreational vessel, you're not sunk at this show because there's so much more to do. You can look at the stuff. There's a slew of activities to navigate with the family, including a Dock Dogs canine aquatics contest, and there's a trout pond, and there's just all manner of things for kids to do, including virtual reality boating. You put on the goggles. Who needs a boat when you can pretend that you're on a boat?
Yeah, you know, I do think a lot of people go to boat shows who have no intention of really ever in their life buying a boat. I would think a boat show in Kansas City is a tougher sell, in fact.
Well, it's a very successful show. This is the 65th annual. You know, wrap your oars around that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think you're right. I think probably more people gawk than buy, but it plants the seed in lake seasons right around the corner.
And, you know, a person can always dream.
I'm dreaming now.
And finally, I'm sensing white tablecloths. I'm sensing candlelight.
Yes. What? A little dinner music.
Yes. And why dinner music, Brian?
Well, because good food, we want it, we need it, and a healthy discount is always appreciated at KC Restaurant Week. Get your discounted eats to benefit the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Kansas City and other causes. It kicks off Friday at 160, count them, 160 area restaurants. Lunch is $15, dinner's $33. These are multi-course meals, and it benefits the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Kansas City.
I will tell you, reservations from experience are already filling up.
They're filling up. So make the call. Check out the website.
And the week lasts longer than a week.
It's 10 days. It's actually a 10-day culinary stretch.
Well, KC Restaurant Week then. Hey, that's Brian McTavish, who writes about pop culture and joins us every week with the Weekend To-Do List.
Trying not to think twice. I'm trying to follow your example, Brian.
Just think. Don't think twice. It's all right. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
On yesterday's program, Kansas Governor Jeff Collier was here. His last day in that office is Sunday, but you can hear his conversation with Steve Kraske about his political past and future anytime at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date, and I'm at ptsbrian. Steve Kraske's back tomorrow, and former Senator Claire McCaskill will be here with him, so tune in. Our program's produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.